Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Germany podcast. I'm Travis Dow, and today I have a special guest co-host, Pete Coleman. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Travis. Great to be here with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you on the show. So this is, for those of you that don't listen to our other shows, like the History of Alchemy or Bohemican, Pete Coleman co-hosts those shows. And I asked him to join me on the History of Germany today because we are talking about the Frisians, of which Pete's ancestors were some.
Exactly. And I'm very interested in being part of this show because I had a chance in early 2015 to take about a week or so to travel all through Ostfriesland, near the Seven Islands or so, not quite to the islands, but around Ostfriesland from Aurich and Strakholt and Firl, and so these very small towns in the area, to get a feel about where my ancestors came from. And it really was an amazing journey. So I'm extremely interested about this particular topic.
Yeah, and I don't know how far people's general knowledge of Germans go, but Frisians, so Frisia, or where the Frisians kind of came from, is on the coast, on the North Sea coast of Germany. We're talking about really close to the Dutch border, that area. And then also on the Dutch side. So there's East Frisians and West Frisians. And the West Frisians are today in Holland, and the East Frisians are today in Germany. And the dialect that they speak today is like, it's Plattdeutsch, German, or North Sea German kind of dialect.
Low Dutch, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. A low German dialect is exactly what it is. And it's not related to the ancient Frisians, the people that gave us our name. And if you've never really heard of the Frisians, then, well, you're going to be pleasantly surprised. There's a lot of great stuff about them on this show. And one of them is that their old language is that they were not related to the Saxons and the Angles that were next to them. And there was even a lot of theories for a long time about the Frisians that came over to England along with the Angles and Saxons, and that the Kentish dialect of southern England and Kent, on coastal England, really is they believed that was more of a Frisian dialect than Saxon or Angle. That was a false theory, so that was eventually disproven. But the Frisians did have an important role in history, and a really interesting one. So basically, the first time they really show up in history is already basically living really close to where we would find them now. So that, northern part of Germany, and after, hundreds of years of slowly migrating south. And at that point, we wouldn't call them Frisians. They might have been known as a subtribe of the Ingevones, or, kind of along the Saxons, alongside the Saxons, perhaps not related to the Saxons, though. And the Chalken, and that's what they're called in German, I'm not sure, but those tribes. And Pliny the Elder, actually technically properly pronounced Pliny the Elder. Did you know that, Pete?
I actually know that because we had him on, a couple shows that we've done before.
We've mentioned that before. I know we've mentioned him for sure. Yeah, when it comes to alchemists or this or that. Oh, yeah, he's come up before. Anyways, he's the first person to really mention your precious Frisians in 12 BC. And this was actually in the context of a battle. And in this context, the Frisians were Roman allies fighting other Germanic tribes.
Can I interject here, Travis? And I want to make sure that this name is actually somewhat familiar. Pliny the Elder, and I believe it's about the same time as the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Mm-hmm. Pliny the Younger, right, his son, witnessed the explosion of Mount Vesuvius.
Right.
And Pliny the Elder was actually, I think, stuck near Herculaneum, leading a group of military people, and was vaporized.
Yeah, is that when he died? Yeah.
Exactly. So Pliny the Younger, if I'm not mistaken, was the one that documented the catastrophic event.
Exactly. He's like the best kind of first or primary source of Roman. Vesuvius. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's good to put that in context. So that's, you know, Pliny the Elder definitely mentions a lot of the first mentions of Germanic tribes that we have in written record are by Pliny the Elder. Like he's written a bunch of stuff about world history at his time. A lot of it's not accurate, but it's the only thing we have in a lot of cases. At least it was the only thing we had until some archaeological evidence.
Roman
allies. So we already see them enter the world stage as having a relationship with Rome. Like they're on the Roman border. They're actually pretty close to the territory that, you know, Caesar was invading and all that. So it's which I've talked about on previous episodes. One thing that is mentioned here is that the Frisians would pay tribute to the Romans. But the Romans, if you've seen, I think it's an extinct species now, but the old European cattle, they're almost like Texan longhorns. And they're called, I'm not sure how to pronounce them, it's like aurochs. Is that how they're, what they're called? You know what I'm talking about?
I have no idea.
basically picture, yeah, you'll see this in like medieval illustrations and even, you know, if a Roman
tapestries source, or those type of things.
Yeah, if a Roman source or early medieval days, if they mention cows or cattle, they are talking about these huge beasts, like way bigger than European cows now. And I think they're trying to rebreed them, you know, kind of by cheating a little bit, recreate the species in like Belarusia or, you know, some place where the closest relatives live of these huge cow, but they're basically extinct. And now if you go to Europe, you see like Holstein cows and, you know, Angus beef and that kind of thing. But in any case, so long story short, the Roman demanded as tribute, pelts of these really huge aurochs, cattle, cows. And Frisian cows, they have, like, even smaller than modern cows, perhaps, they had really tiny cattle. And the Frisians just couldn't, you know, if the Romans wanted 10 hides, then the Frisians could give them 10 hides, but they would be tiny, so the Romans would want 15. And now we're talking a significant portion of the Frisians', you know, cattle stock. So what they would have to do is they would end up basically selling their women and children to slavery. So the Frisians, so we see them enter the world stage at, you know, kind of a disadvantage already, you know, really rock bottom, you know, selling their women and children. It doesn't get much worse than that. It's similar how I introduced the Goths, oddly enough.
It's because you're selling your future. I mean, that's what it comes down to. You're bartering away your future as a people, you know, which they really didn't just willingly do without a grudge, Travis, you know. And crucified the next Romans that came by to collect the tribute. There was a growing sense of angst that was coming through between the Romans and the Frisians. And so the Frisians enter this world stage, as you said, with a chip on their shoulder.
As
right?
Crucifying Romans. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, Germans may know them from pop culture, or at least if you might see them as old as maybe you and I are, Travis, from the German comedian Otto and the whole Otto Fatten cartoon and comics. Now, I'm not too familiar with that, Travis, but you grew up in Munich. And this is something that you grew up with. Is that correct?
So you don't know this, but I've actually made Otti Fanten references to you, and you just, you know, won't trade over your head. But because every time you mention Frisians, this is what I think of actually as an 80s kid, I should say, in growing up in Germany, is Otto. I didn't even look up his last name. If I say Otto to my German listeners, they'll know exactly who I mean.
Exactly.
If I say Otti Fanten, if they're my age or older, they know exactly what I'm talking about. And he was this comedian in the 80s, and he made he was a stand-up comedian, basically, but then he made these comics that turned into cartoons of these elephants that, because his name is Otto, they were Ottifants, okay? And these Otti Fanten, and they would, you know, they were cute, and you could buy Valentine's cards and birthday cards and Christmas cards, and it was a thing. You know, it was a thing in the 80s. There was A-Team, there was Alf, and there was Otti Fanten, okay? And the Cosby Show, yeah, okay? So that, gotcha. You know, Hasselhoff, Knight Rider, you know, that was Germany in the 80s and Otti Fanten. So it was a huge phenomenon. This guy actually made some movies. One of them is Otto Goes to America, where he ends up going to Florida to try and save some. A lot of it's about saving some East Frisian landmark or the East Frisian landscape itself. Like at one point, they wanted to build a huge like bullet train right through the countryside, and it, you know, the model destroyed the beautiful landscape and crushed his. I think he was in a lighthouse or something. I'm going off of like 20-year-old memories here. I haven't rewatched them any, you know, recently at all. But he was like, you know, his lighthouse got tipped over, and he's like, I must go to America and save East Frisia.
Here's the thing. Otto Fonten is it brings a, I would say probably a very negative stereotype to the Frisian background of this. This is something like a tongue in cheek sort of cow tipping sort of. For those of us in America listening, it would be what people would say about West Virginians and Appalachians.
Yes,
in a lot of ways.
Yeah, very much because a big central role of his comedy, whether it was stand up or anything, was he did funny voices. Okay, that was actually really he did funny voices, but his East Frisian dialect was one that all Germans recognize, and it instantly speaks of them, of their shitty summer vacation where they went to northern Germany instead of Italy. Regretted that, but they're there and it's raining but they're at the beach and you know, all the locals are talking funny, and the way that they were talking was like this guy. And so they all know it, you know. Everybody's been there, everybody's been to the islands. We took a class trip from Bavaria there when I was a kid, to East Frisia, and we walked to one of the islands and everything. You know, when the tide goes out, like you can walk.
Exactly.
Maybe
we should give an idea to our listeners that aren't familiar with that. There are seven islands, is that right? Seven islands that are on the coast, and they kind of dot outside. They're just like, if you can imagine like the Outer Banks in North Carolina, that sort of feel. Now, when the tide does go out, like you were mentioning, Travis, you can actually walk out to the islands. However,
to some of them, yeah.
Yeah, to some of them. And the deal is that you need to be sure that you're going to stay there, or you're going to walk your butt back, because you will be swept out to sea if you don't get back in time.
Yeah, so you definitely don't try this on your own. We had a guide. Absolutely do not do this on your own. People do die, definitely. Because we had a guide that knows, okay, the tide is going out, now is the time. And you can be trapped out in the middle as soon as the tide starts to come back in, because these little streams start to get bigger and bigger. So you're just on an island, and then suddenly you can be a mile out to sea.
Yeah.
The tide goes out, to give you perspective, the tide goes out 3 kilometers, about 2 miles. So we walked a mile and a half or 2 miles to the island. So yeah, if the tide comes in and you're caught out in it, you're a mile out to sea. So yeah, be warned, but it's great fun. And we basically walked to an island and then waited for the tide to come in and took a boat back. So,
To give you perspective about what the landscape is like out there, it's flat.
Dikes.
It reminds me a lot of Illinois, where my Colemans wind up settling, but Illinois meets maybe the Florida Everglades without the heat. It has its very soggy sort of conditions, those type of things. And when you say that people kind of settle for going there on vacations, if you're from Germany, yeah, you can see that. I think nowadays that they're trying to really promote that as a way to getting out there and enjoying nature and bike trails and wonderful things like that. You really can't compare it to taking a trip to Croatia. Okay, it's not the same thing. It is a nice place for recreation, but it is very bucolic. There are several windmills that are still in existence there to give you kind of a Dutch feel.
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of dikes there that are considered ancient dikes. And one thing that I realized when I was there that was just amazing was they did them wrong. At the first, they didn't make them zigzag like they're supposed to. They made them, perpendicular, parallel.
They learned as
they
went.
Just fell apart. Yeah. Exactly. So, and one of the coolest stories about, and I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but this I think is really neat, was that you could farm as a colonist these areas that would flood, but you were in charge of that part of the dike.
Right.
That was your responsibility. Now, if for some reason you couldn't make things grow and you just said, I can't live on this land anymore, what you did is you took your shovel and you plopped it right on the top of the dike and you walked away. No harm, no foul. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so the next guy could just pick up, if you even left your house there, pick up, if you picked up that shovel,
he's
the owner.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so it was hard living. And, you know, I'm talking all the way up into the very late 19th century. This is how things go. And you can see in a lot of ways that people from Frankfurt or Saxony or, you know, you can name it in Germany, Berlin, that they would look very differently on the Frisians because they were not really quite the same Germans as you would think. Yeah. You know, they were kind of different folk.
And interestingly, even genetically, so that was kind of new to me. I just read that a couple of years ago, is that they're even different than their neighbors because they're a totally different West Germanic branch. So now their original dialect is totally dead. They just speak Platt German like everybody else in the area. But they didn't. But they're still, you know, they're still like genetically, they're still their own Western Germanic kind of, you know, they have their own DNA. Which is interesting.
All right, so Travis, Frisians don't play a major role on the world stage as any kind of mighty empires, you might say, but they hang in there just long enough, right? Yeah, so they hold on to who they are as a group of people. And you can find Frisians exactly around the area where the Romans first found them themselves. And they also went on raiding, and they it's assumed that they went with the Angles and the Saxons and their neighbors, which would make sense because they were so close to the ocean. In the North Sea, and in the backyard of what we consider most Vikings or, you know, Angles or Saxons. So, you know, what is likely is that this population had a dip in the 5th century when they started to come back just in time to be conquered by the Franks. So before the 5th century, the Utes, and I'm kind of thinking about my cousin Vinny right now. two Utes? What are two Utes?
What are two Utes?
Okay, if you know what I mean, we'll just move on. The Utes actually didn't migrate straight from Jutland over to the North Sea. So if you look at the map, it is actually that the Frisians, who were the closest to the British Isles, really had that kind of connection. And you might see some of the, you talked about the genetics, there's some of those genetic traits are shared between that short area that can be jumped over the North Sea. And the Utes actually came through the Frisian land, not so friendly terms, by the way, to get to the channel and cross the water more safely than to Britain. Mm-hmm. Okay. In the 6th and 7th centuries, the Frisians spread out as south as Bruges. That's just, you know, very close to Brussels, so to speak, and on to the Vesa.
Yep.
In 734, the western part is conquered by Karl Martell.
Yeah, and I'm going to talk about the Franks, obviously, in a future episode, and I'll talk about Karl Martell and all that. So they get, I mean, I guess the point here is they get conquered very early on. The Franks would deal with the Saxons much later, and even the Lombards, that would be like, you know, Charlemagne's time. So, but yeah, the Frisians kind of get swept up.
You know, so Travis, we mentioned Karl Martell, or Charles Martell the Hammer, all right? And why is he important to the Franks? Because he is the grandfather, am I mistaken, of Charlemagne, who basically is the guy that brought all of Europe out of the Dark Ages, so to speak. And so there's this giant connection that the Frisians have to the Franks during the Charlemagne expansion that would later on follow. Pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, before Charlemagne conquers them is when Frisians would have their biggest borders. Like you said, from Bruges to the Weser, this would kind of be known as Frisia Magna, or like Greater Frisia. It was like the greatest extent of Frisia's borders. And then, yeah, Karl Martell started whittling them down. The Saxons joined in to get a piece. And then, yeah, by Charlemagne's time, Charlemagne took over the rest. And in Charlemagne's time is when the Frisians get their oldest law, that, you know, at least their oldest written law, I should say, because there was probably tribal rules and law and cultural norms before this. But in 785... when Charlemagne conquers the rest, shortly after that date, we have the Lex Frisoronum, like basically the law of the Frisians. And this is really cool. I mentioned other, like the Lex Burgundium and, you know, some of those other ones that are really important. I'll mention the Lombard law also. Oh yeah, so it's in this time when we first see them writing down their laws, and these laws would be very strong, actually. Like Germanic law would be like the kings and emperors wouldn't even be exempt. And this is, you know, this becomes important later in the Holy Roman Empire. So anyways, yeah. So to get back to the Frisians and to get back to the 8th century, The Frisians would really prosper as a people, and they moved into like the northern Frisian islands, which, you know, you mentioned, and then even some area right off the Danish coast. And those would actually kind of like a colony. They would live under the Danish king, but as Frisian people. And then, you know, in this time, the Frisians, this is kind of the time when the Frisians were Christianized, just like the Saxons and some other tribes. When the Franks conquered everybody, they forced Christianity upon them, basically. They made everybody convert. And I'll talk more about that when I talk about the Saxons. I have some specific examples and what the process looked like and everything. And it's, so I'm going to jump over it now, is my point. But that all happened in the next 100 years, in the 9th century. And they started to spread out outside of the Frankish realm, like I said, like towards Denmark, towards today's Schleswig in northern Germany, kind of towards the east of their core region, and, you know, spreading and mixing their dialect with the local German dialects that, you know, there might be some evidence of that still today. By the way, before I move on from dialects altogether, I just wanted to mention, in case you're wondering, the Frisian dialect is the North Sea Germanic branch of the West Germanic languages. And in German, that's actually way cooler, because I can't make fun of this in the German version. So I just have to say this with a straight face. But this is two words, folks. Die Nordsee Germanische Zweig Westgermanischer Sprachen. Three words. Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of like it's to put that into context of what else belongs in that group, we're looking at Old Nether German, old Low German, basically. Old English is that branch, in case you were wondering. So the North Sea Germanic branch of the West Germanic languages, Old English is one of them. Same as Saxon and Utes and Angles, you know, that kind of combined made Old English. So with absolutely some Frisian, influence. People just don't know how strong of one, but definitely a Frisian influence.
Well, you hear that, Travis, when, you know, one of the greetings that you hear in East Frisia is moin moin. Yeah. When you see somebody, it sounds almost like morning morning, but moin moin is what everybody says. It's not, you know, guten tag. It's moin moin. And you talk about the differences between, you know, these regionalities here. And if you listen to some of the, when I was listening to some of the Frisian or the Plattdeutsch, you almost catch it for a minute. You're going, oh my, was that English? No.
What? Yeah, kind of, exactly.
It throws you off.
I have that feeling with Dutch, because I speak English and German. Dutch is like really weird, because it's, I can almost understand it. It's I can read it pretty well. It's hard for me to understand sometimes, just because the pronunciation is different. But it's a mix of English and German in a way that I'm like, it's just like, what is that? Yeah, it's really confusing, because it's so close and yet different. So, but yeah, okay, let's drop languages. I want to talk about this Frisian freedom. And I know you looked this up, so I'll let you take it. This right here is the best part of the podcast. This is because, you know, just because under the Franks, while all the Franks, I mean, the Franks are basically responsible for the later medieval feudal system, period. The way that you had fealty to a lord, and he, you know, owed something, tribute and taxes and men to a duke or a count or whatever, and then, you know, up the chain to the king, that was very Frankish, even more so than Roman or anybody else. The Frankish spin on that is what became the European model. But the Frisians, you know, would have none of it, basically.
And they wouldn't. And on my podcast, on the Bohemian podcast, we talk about the Czech people trying to, especially at the turn of the 20th, from the 19th to the 20th century, trying to gain about who they were as a culture, trying to reinvent their language and bring it back from the dead. So it wasn't German, it was Czech, and their culture as well, that was basically suppressed for several hundred years by the Habsburgs. I want you to think about this for a minute with the Frisians. There's a saying at the end of the 19th century that goes back to their hope to regain what it meant to be Frisian. Mm-hmm. They try to reinstitute going into the 20th century. And one of the sayings, and I will butcher the German, so I'm not going to say it in German, but it's hail to the free Frisians, better dead than a slave. All right.
Yeah.
So this talks about that inherent freedom that they had coursing through their Frisian blood. in their veins. You know, so this story is just plain awesome. I mean, either a special right was granted to the Frisians by Charles the Great, as we talked about, or the Frisians just made this up themselves, which makes it even better of a story.
Yeah.
But the story kind of goes like this.
If you think about it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But Charlemagne, Charles the Great, granted the Frisians the right to have no lord over them except the emperor himself. And this was in stark contrast to the rest of the Frankish Empire that was ruled very heavily, okay?
Yeah.
The Frankish Empire as a whole is basically what gave us the medieval feudal system that we talked about, and the Franks will have their own show, as it already is written, so we don't really want to worry about that right now. But basically, starting with the early Frankish kings, that they had a method of tribute, recruiting fighting men. Taxation became those that are very familiar to medieval cliches that we run into, but not for the Frisians. They had a special sort of deal, all right? The Frisians, for one, did not welcome their Frankish overlords very well, okay? They were stubborn. They liked their freedom. According to the Frisian legend of Liber Friso, which means free Frisian, this is and his compatriots that had come back in the 9th century victorious from Italy back to their homes on the North Sea. In Rome, the Frisians had triumphed completely and unexpectedly in the name of their king Charles, not yet the Great, not Magna.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
He hadn't gotten to that point yet. All right, he wasn't even named an 800, Holy Roman Emperor. That hasn't happened just yet.
Right.
The king was ecstatic. He had rewarded and gifted his brave Frisian warriors with the highest reward, freedom. This version of the story we owe to the time of Carl the Fat, or Carl the Third of the East Frankish Empire, which is the direct predecessor of Germany. In fact, it may have been Charles the Fat who gave the Frisians this freedom after they helped him to beat the Normans, which were the Vikings as we know today, and he had just made up this story to make it even more honorable, to kind of give him some gravitas about why he did this.
Yeah,
okay?
Right.
Politics,
yeah.
Man, politics.
Uh-huh.
This is politics is local, right? So, but the Frisians took this right very seriously. They didn't take it as some kind of political sort of maneuver. Nobility just could not get a grip on the Frisians. While the Frisians often had the help from their Frankish kings in defending against the Vikings, the Frisians also had the help themselves. So instead of relying on a Frankish lord for protection, like what happened for most of the Frankish Empire, instead the Frisians started around the year 800 to choose their own leaders among the farmers. Okay, a very agriculturally based society.
Yeah. This is really cool. So they started to, I guess, just because they were all farmers, they were all basically egalitarian. And you know what? Like, if you think about the landscape, it's so flat. It's not like anybody lived on a hill and, you know, could defend easier than anybody else. No, they all lived on these floodplains, you know, behind dikes.
And that's the thing. If you go through this town, if you go through this landscape, you will see beautiful areas of rape seed growing, which is, I guess, considered canola oil. You know, we get canola oil from in the States. Beautiful, bright yellow fields and bright green, wheat. It's an amazing place in that sense. But man, it is flat. Except if you do see how hills, especially where churches were built, it's man-made. That is it's all man-made. It doesn't exist in nature there.
Yep. So yeah, exactly. It's just amazingly flat. So, I mean, yeah, the fact that the tide goes out 2 miles should really paint a picture. So the way this evolved was these were all like really, really egalitarian farmers, okay? And then they would vote for a councilman. They would call it a redieve, which, now the Latinized Franks, who were, pretending to be Romans, basically, they would have called this man a consul, okay? So in a sense, the Frisians would, of a certain community, of an area, of a farmer community, they would get together and vote for their councilman. That's a good way to say it in English. But the modern, so in German, This even makes sense. Like German, the modern word for Redjewe, if I said that right, would be Ratgeber, as in counsel giver. So yeah, like a councilman, you know, board, an advice giver. Advice giver is really what it means. So not someone that rules by any means, but someone that you come to with your complaints, and he's more like a judge where he will give you advice and you can take it or leave it. You know, but that's what the Redjewe says. And, you know, maybe they'll all agree, maybe not. But not a lord. You don't pay tribute. You don't pay taxes. You don't give him men for the army or for defense. None of that. You defend yourselves as a community. So, I mean, and this really, like, over the centuries, this kind of changed because it lasted until the 14th century or sometimes even, you know, as you mentioned, the idea itself never died. You know, it sparked up again the 19th century.
But anyway, over the centuries, these councilmen and all other public officials would be elected by the population. Well, all of them, just the men, of course, I guess, having an equal vote, and for one-year terms. So you have term limits, which is something that I think is something that we all actually like to talk more about in our current political status, right? These councilmen would then get together and discuss agreements on trade and defense, etc. This place is where they met. I really wouldn't call it a capital, but their capital had a great name of Upstalabum. Is that right?
Yeah. Upstalbum. Okay. Upstalbum. It's a little tiny village near Aurich
And Aurich is a major seat now in Ostfriesland.
Yeah, have you been to Aurich?
I have been. It's actually a beautiful little town, but that's where their main archives for that region is located. And Aurich was, if I'm not mistaken, was bombed very heavily during World War II.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, a lot of these places.
Today, yeah. I know it's like Aurich is one center and Leia is another center that people might have heard of. You know,
Leia is, if you can imagine, is a very gentrified area that's been around for a very long time, but it's a very picturesque sort of Ostfriesland sort of a town that is really cleaned up quite well. Aurich is more of a business community and has a lot of nice places as well and some very interesting Frisian museums. So that would be a place to go see information about what it means to be Frisian. Absolutely. Yeah.
So Upstalbum, how do you feel about that name?
That's a great name.
Is that just like the best capital ever?
ever.
From Upstalbum, West Frisia or East Frisia. Oh, man. Yeah, that's actually a good example of kind of Dutch or Frisian names, Upstalbum. So, yeah. And at the height of this kind of Frisian freedom, basically, in the, let's say, 13th and 14th centuries is kind of when this became the strongest, was the biggest political entity, when this, you know, form of government worked, had the biggest power, I would say. At this time, they had up to like around 27 communities that each had their elected redve, and then of course they would all meet in Upstalbum every year and, you know, decide these important matters like defense and whatnot. But eventually, the area went through a couple of troubled generations, like there was famine or war and that sort of thing. And this actually happens to the area now and then, like even including the history of why Frisians came to America. But here in the 14th century, it lasted for quite a while. There was a time of famine, and then the Frisians just basically weren't doing so well, and they started to lose their egalitarian culture because the Redveyes started to tend to come from families, you know? They're just certain families ended up being richer than others, and they ended up being the Redveyes more often than not. And that kind of increased the cycle of them becoming even richer. And just basically in this time of famine, the Redveyes didn't go, or the families of these council givers did not go as hungry as the other population. So we see a shift from, you know, everything being egalitarian to actually having a sort of nobility class. There were some families that were just well, you know, more well-to-do than others. And we even see a change in the name from Redveje, which means council giver, to the modern title of Hovetling, which it's still a noble title in Dutch, I guess. And the modern German equivalent would be Häuptling, which really means chieftain. So from council giver to chieftain, okay, that really should tell you something. Like now it is a person that has something to say. He has commands to give and people to, you know, people follow him. So it's different. So we see this shift in mentality as this noble class does end up actually developing. Yeah. And then we basically see feudalism taking over as anywhere else. That ended, you know, that was the end of the Frisian freedom as a reality. Then it still became an idea, but there's another sign of the Frisian freedom and a sign that it was coming to an end. And that is that the Frisians made fun of knights. They hated castles. We'll get into this for a second. But that's all about to change too. But there's one other interesting tidbit of you know, trivia you might have not known. And that is that, you know, everybody knows the country New Zealand, right? But have you ever, so does that ever make you ask the question, where is Old Zealand?
It never does. It never does.
You just don't care. You're like, no.
What it is, face value. It's new.
It's just New Zealand. It's just New Zealand.
It's like Nova Scotia. It's like, it's just there.
Yeah, but that's, New Caledonia. Okay. New Caledonia. So
New York. Okay, New York.
Yeah, I've never actually heard of York. I don't think it's a real place.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Frankly. I mean, come on.
A lot of people in England right now are very angry with you.
Sorry. Anyways, so yeah, I love those Yorkshire folks. If you were wondering about Old Zealand, this also comes from the Frisians. During the Frisian freedom, there was also something known as the Seven Frisian Sea Lands. And Sea Land it's still one of the Netherlands, basically. It's in Holland now. But anyways, there was the Seven Frisian Sea Lands, or just the Seven Sea Lands, basically. And yeah, Zealand, even spelled with a Z, is still one of the Netherlands, basically. So, you know, if you're ever wondering where that was, it's in Holland, or it's in the Netherlands. But yeah, so, you know, in this time, they were reliant on self-defense. They were reliant on self-defense in the Roman times. In Charlemagne's times, they were basically a coastal guard against the Vikings, like you said. But not, you know, weren't really a big fighting force. But yeah, I mean, so this egalitarian society, this reliance on self-defense really gave them the knight, you know, the symbol of a knight, as a hated symbol, like something to be vilified. Like if a knight strolled through town, you know, people would just be giving them dirty looks, I'm sure. Like Frisians just hated that. And this is a really interesting thing I came across, and I only came across it in German, so I'm going to translate as I go here. But I came across an old law that is a part of the law called as the Brokma Recht, the Brokma Right. And this is a law I found that is against castles because, yeah, did you know this? Like, they took this seriously.
So
they actually, so if you were rich enough that you could say as a merchant or as a, you know, very successful land-owning farmer, let's say, with a big family, you could afford a castle. Well, you might want to rethink that. So here they're talking about burg, like a fortress, basically. So they're defining what a burg, you know, the term burg, right? Like a fortress kind of, but
right.
It means it's not a one-to-one translation, but like Hamburg, Salzburg. So if you're thinking like, I'm going to build myself Kolmenburg, think twice, because the Brookmen passed the following law that no one can build burgs or fortresses or walls or high stone houses under the penalty of 8 marks. Okay. And if the stone house is higher than 12 rutenfuss, I have no idea
what metric is that?
I have no idea. It's some sort of foot, so it could be, but it's clearly longer than a foot. I would guess like a yard or more. But if it's, so let's say, so 12, you know, let's say it's like 2 or 3 stories, something like that. I don't know. So if you build a stone house higher than 3 stories, let's say, and or a basement that is 2 stories deep. And I think that's interesting because that might imply a dungeon. I don't know, you know, like as opposed to just a cellar, it's a defendable thing or somewhere where you could keep a prisoner. I don't know what the logic is.
Maybe.
But
yeah.
In that case, again, you will be penalized 8 marks. And now, and this is paragraph 150, if someone wanted to look it up. But 8 marks, I guess, must have been a fortune to really, for a wealthy nobleman to be like, 8 marks, so I guess I'm not building a burg then. You know what I mean? Like, cigarettes used to cost 8 marks. So it must have been a lot of money at that time, is what I'm saying. So yeah, no high stone walls or houses, no basements that were deeper than 2 floors, maybe because of dungeons or maybe because you could actually defend this, I don't know. And no stone houses over 12 rutin feet, whatever that means. So yeah, so you're being charged, I don't know what the exchange rate was, but the last exchange rate that I remember was 2 marks to a dollar. So I'm sure it was different than that. But yeah, I mean, so eventually they did need these laws because just naturally they were less and less egalitarian. You know, some people became richer than others. So I came across that law and had to show that from
the Frisians that kind of that I can at least trace my ancestry to the 1700s and the 1800s. There was this, you know, lack of ostentatiousness. I mean, if that's a word, they were people that,
yeah.
And this also goes, there were later on in the 18th century, there were these amazing chateaus and money and landowners. And so it did flip eventually.
We'll get to that. But
the people were very kind of down to earth folk when it comes to certain things. And you saw that in their Lutheran backgrounds. They were kind of hard folks. They liked to do some fun things on occasion, and they followed certain festivals during the course of the year. But when it came to, trying to fall into line under the yoke of something like the Catholic Church or, some kind of potentate or land owner in a feudal system, they had none of it. They wanted none of it.
Yeah. No, I think that stays. That part stayed in their culture forever. You know, you don't have a lot more than you need, and you don't need to have a lot more than your neighbors and so forth, you know. Yeah, okay, what I was going to say was, yeah, but there was a way around this law that they found because you researched it. I'll let you
okay.
You know, what was this loophole? Because they did kind of skirt this law eventually.
And so, Travis, they would build a stone house as big as they could get away with under this sort of law, and they could often afford a much bigger place, of course, but yet they would not live in these houses at this time. They would just still live in their farms and on their land and live very modestly, but you would see these, you know, bigger homes. And so we see some cities with up to 5 of these big family houses, each one competing with the other Joneses in the neighborhood, so to speak. And eventually these turned into stone towers right at an important marketplace or harbors as the landholders begin to live in them, you know. And because of the aforementioned catastrophes, the owners of these domestic stone towers and the disparity between the regular farmers and these families started to grow. So very interesting stuff. So the heads of these richest of the families would start calling themselves Hoveslinge, which is basically these consuls, right? You know, these chieftains.
Yeah.
Okay?
Now they're more chieftains instead of like council givers.
It's right.
Like there's a difference. Like I think, you know, if you're speaking to a councilman, that's different than if you're speaking to the chieftain. Like everybody knows, okay, this guy's in charge. It's a different message. It's no longer that egalitarian. You know, it's changing for sure.
So you see, Travis, these chieftains started kind of flexing their muscles again, and you start seeing the feudal society kind of creep back into what is very common through most of the Germanic lands and most of Europe. So you see that there's something lost here from the ancient sort of Frisians or free sort of mentality and the austerity that they once had. They would fall into line, you know, like everybody else. And there would be landowners and landlords and people that would toil their lives away without any really chance to kind of move up that ladder.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, in these tough times, I came across another story that I thought was really interesting. Because I love the history of pirates. And there's also a podcast out there, by the way. But we start to see Frisians doing a little bit of piracy of their own because it is really tough times for a couple of generations. And one trick they use, because what if you're so poor that you can't even afford a boat, okay? What they would do is they would use lights on beaches, because again, it's very, very flat land, so it's very easy to get beached if you're not coming into a proper harbor. So they would use lights to create the illusion of a lighthouse and, you know, causing merchant ships to beach, and then they just wait for the tide to go out the rest of the way and plunder the ships
from land.
Yeah, so I was like, when I read that, I'm like, oh my God, that's so simple and yet so brilliant. So that did happen. And then this would also be one of the methods of attacking their neighbors. So they would even, you know, in a foggy day, trick their neighbors who know the area very well. And this was just, you know, one facet of this sort of, you know, medieval tribal warfare that was going on.
Well, and Travis, you talk about a group of people here that are able to make nature bend to their needs as the years and the centuries roll on. You know, these folks would make canals. They would make these man-made canals to get from one place to the other. So when this flooded sort of waterlogged area, they would use these small sort of craft, rafts, if you will, you know, on a sticks to kind of move themselves down these canals that you would see in a lot of other places for trade and for transportation, because you really couldn't make a road that would be waterlogged. Eventually, they would make these roads, corduroy roads, where they would just take down the trees and basically, you know, put them at substantial so they couldn't get washed away, and they would still use that. Yet the canals were a main source of transportation all the way through the 20th century. When it would freeze, and it doesn't freeze much anymore up there, but when it would freeze, they would just basically use these kind of like ice skates and sleds and be able to go from plate to place.
That's actually a good point to call out on the show, is that if people haven't been to like Holland or Northern Belgium and those areas, like the canals, basically every town and city, just think Venice. Seriously, like even Amsterdam, you know, there's a street and then the next street will be a canal, and then there's a street and the next street will be a canal. So you can get around by boat just as well as you could by car. In fact, you know, the streets are congested, so but you could get around by boat as well as you could by on foot or by bicycle. Like, boat is just one more way to get from point A to point B anywhere downtown in any of those villages and towns. Like, it's just, you know, Bruges is, you know, you can take a boat taxi, you can take boat tours. It's just crazy. Like, it's absolutely, that's a really good point to make. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, and the Frisians, you know, they were very based in agriculture. There's a Frisian horse that's, you know, type of horse that is known for these folks breeding there as well. If you go to Ostfriesland today, you might see cows. You know, they're black and white cows, and they're, you know, kind of known for their agriculture in that sense of raising these cows. But the cows wouldn't be on the marshy area because they're too heavy. They would sink into their knees.
You see a lot of sheep.
And a sheep, you know, just graze. They graze. You see a lot of sheep, and they're beautiful up there, you know, and those type of things. So their animal husbandry was something that they knew how to do. Another thing that was amazing was they knew how to live in these conditions that people would say, I don't want anything of it. Reclamated land. You know, they would go out and say, we're going to do peat farming. And that was something that was done for hundreds of years of going out and you know, taking the sludge that you would have underneath these tides and packing it into bricks, firing it, and using it as fuel.
In fact, you might not realize this, but many, many of the canals are actually due to a direct result, like a side effect of peat farming, because the canals, you know, they would have this in mind. They would dig the peat out along a certain trench, and then it would automatically, you know, flood with water. And peat is it's kind of like clay. It's very firm, which means the sides of the canals would stay put and everything, and, you know, collapse a little bit over the years. But for centuries, like, they're still there. Those, you know, someone dug out the peat and you know,
it's part of the sea life. I mean, and you'll see people that deal with fishing industries, and it's just part of life there. It's almost akin to what you would see in North America, in Maine, where people live along the coast, and they live off the sea.
Yeah, it's all a big system, because then even so the dikes are not wasted land either, because, you know, the sheep can graze on that steep incline. So the dikes are not wasted, you know, because you can't farm on it. It is too steep to farm on. But OK, so that's where you have your sheep. And then the dikes aren't enough. It would still flood. So what you need is pumps. And medieval water pumps, well, that's what those windmills are. Because it's so flat, you get a good, constant, consistent wind, velocity, whatever, pressure. So you can build windmills like crazy. And that's what they did. And once you have windmills, well, with windmills, they don't just pump water. They also, you can hook them up to a millstone, you can hook them up to a sawmill, you can hook them up to all kinds of stuff that just get the economy going. And and then later in history, we see Belgian towns doing exactly that. They were at the forefront of these weaving towns and creating the cloth, spinning cloth, and then weaving it, and that came way before, to some degree, before the Industrial Revolution, because they had these mills already. They had these machines that they were running on wind power, that they just hook it up and say, oh yeah, we have off we go, instead of horses, instead of many other technologies that the rest of Europe was reliant upon. So because of that, they could afford to not have castles and to not have knights, and so it's a really interesting culture if you think about it. And I will come back to the history of the Dutch in general, but I will revert back to this episode a lot when I do so. So that's why I wanted to kind of set the foundation there. And we won't be coming back to the Frisians themselves anytime soon, because we have to talk about the Saxons and Franks and all those guys first. Yeah,
there's a lot, I'm sure, on your list.
Yeah, I got Habsburg. One thing, so the Frisians started to get in conflict towards the very end, when I mentioned this piracy part. They started to come in contact with the Hanse cities. And the Hanse cities, I have two books on them already. They're not for another 10 podcasts, but I love the history of the Hanse towns. We're talking like Hamburg, Lübeck, Bremen. And then they had a presence in the UK, in Sweden, Denmark, you name it. Venice, by the way. So they went, and it was a way to compete with some of the Mediterranean powerhouse, and a way to get goods from Venice to all the way to the Baltic and the North Sea. So I'm jumping way ahead. That's like later medieval, Renaissance times, basically. But it was, the Frisians, because of their piracy, they kind of got the wrong attention. So and so at the end of their, not at the end of their history, but at the end of this, downturn, at the end of the Frisian freedom and the beginning of just feudalism proper, they do come across with they do come across the Hanse cities and anti-piracy efforts by the Hanseatic League. So they'll come up again. I'm actually going to mention specific pirates who the Hanseatic League fought. So this will all come up again.
And if I can interject here too, Travis, we haven't talked about this, and I think this is really part and parcel of the experience of what it is to be Frisian, and to a certain extent, maybe not so much today, but it definitely was maybe even 100 years ago and before that.
Were you going to talk about the Christianization and that kind of thing?
Yeah. Okay. Just real briefly, yeah.
Cool.
Just talk about the religious aspect of what was going on in this area. You had so much things that were going on in Europe, especially Western Europe, that the Frisians had, unfortunately, a front row seat to. The Napoleonic Wars were won.
Right.
So you would have people in Frisia trying to do their own thing, and then who would come up? It would be the French. And then it would be the Brits. The Brits would come in and they would take over for a few weeks.
Yep.
And then the French would take over. I think it was Napoleon III might have been the case, where Napoleon Bonaparte was actually one of the first that instituted the idea of patronyms. So, to get away from that,
story. Yeah,
exactly. Because it was so confusing. So in other words, just like you might see like in Russia, if your father was named Michael, then your name was, Peter Michael or Mikhailovich. Okay. It was kind of like that sort of thing. And so it was so confusing about who was who. And so Napoleon kind of brought that in, and I believe it was his nephew that ran this area during the Napoleonic area. And people were forced to have, pick these last names. And some of those names, like mine, the Zimmermans, which I think is carpenter in German. The Colemans, I might have been close to something. I might have been a teacher. These names were picked out. So when you're trying to do genealogy, good luck. All right. There's a certain point where you're like, okay, I can't.
There's hundreds of thousands of Petersons or.
Yeah, it's all over the place. So it makes it very difficult. But we talk about, that one of the biggest things that happened besides the Napoleonic Wars, we go back even further than that, we talk about, the 30 Years' War. All right, we're talking about the split between the Catholic Church and the rise of Protestantism. And this really was one of the leading areas. I think there was something like 74 monasteries in all of Frisia. Maybe more than that. It was something insane, close to 100. So it was very, very Catholic. In the early days, the Catholics would send in missionaries to turn the pagans to Christianity, to Catholicism. And they would set these monasteries everywhere. Now, you look at it today, it's not a very Catholic country at all. It's Lutheran, mm-hmm. all right? And so what would happen is they would just go in, and it happened basically overnight. You would have these kind of wealthy, organized towns like Reisum is a town that's in Ostfriesland, and it was started off as a cloister and a monastic sort of area. Within several years after the Reformations, you would have these monks that were kicked out begging on the street for food and charity from people that basically kicked them out because they were homeless. They had nothing. They had no place to go. So it was a very sad time in a lot of ways during this connection. As we move further, we see that we have the Reformed versus the Lutherans. And if you look at the churches, you'll see a great idea to tell you who was Reformed and who was just plain Lutheran. I think it's a swan is actually the weather vane that's on top of these churches, meant that they were Reformed, if I'm not mistaken. So there was a schism within the Lutheran church that people had to pick sides. Now, why is this important to today's Frisians? Well, I think you can see that there's some of this literally teetotaling mm-hmm. mentality of not going over the top, not being like you might see with the rest of Germany, where it's like, dude, let's do Oktoberfest. We're drinking ourselves to oblivion down in Munich, right? Never, never, never in Friesland.
But now there's some pretty good beers that came out of those monasteries, though.
Absolutely, so. But the
Reformed were totally against it. Yep,
exactly. That was it. And it was very, very common for ministers to tell people, do not drink beer anymore. Beer is going to lead you down the sinful path. Drink more tea. drink more tea will be good. So seriously, you would drink black tea in the morning to wake you up at 4 a.m. before you went out and did your stuff with peat farming or with the animals. And then you would come back and drink another pot of tea. And that would be something that wouldn't have a lot of ceremony. But at high noon or at high tea time, during the course of the day when you're getting a little tired, you would have people come over. And I actually had to experience that when I went on this tour of Ostfriesland this year. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance with this, all right? What you serve, the kind of the sweets that you eat with it, and how you pour your milk into the tea is very unique sort of way of doing it with a spoon and putting it in. Okay. That when you dump the sugar cube into it, it has a sort of a hissing sound to it all. And that's when you know you did it right. And so it's something that my Colemans in America didn't really follow up with, but I'm sure their ancestors did. And it makes sense. I mean, the tea coming through the port of Amsterdam is not far, far away.
Right. Yep.
And that would make sense that would be easier to get a hold of at times. And so this is a very highly tea-oriented society in Frisia that has a lot to do with maybe the puritanical sort of viewpoint of making sure that you're not going to be breeding alcoholics because of the very strict Lutheran background. So it kind of does go hand in hand, at least from my perspective. And it's kind of a neat thing to kind of see that is very different from the rest of Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that sounds a lot more Dutch to me. Like I'll kind of touch on some of that stuff a lot when I'll do I don't know if it'll be later. Because I want to do like history of Switzerland, history of Austria, history of, but then I'll do history of Netherlands to some degree and probably not do it justice. But yeah, that sounds like you're describing Holland, or the Netherlands a lot to me too. Like I have a friend
family. It
feels
like it. It feels like it. Yeah.
Like they're out in Middelburg. They're the opposite, like complete western end of of Holland, but still like very proper with their breakfast, with their meals, with their, there's definitely afternoon coffee or tea, you know, and dessert. And, oh yeah. And it's that same society. They actually, well, you know, they took me to one of the churches, like on a Sunday to worship. Like they actually took me to one of the churches right in the middle of the town, in the highest point of Middleburg, which used to be an island. Now it's a peninsula. I think I brought this up before elsewhere somewhere. But it was built round because they distinctly wanted it to be not Catholic. And originally they had the pastor or preacher or whatever you call him. And it's not Lutheran in their case. I guess it was Calvinist. Is that right?
Very possible. John Calvin. Right?
In Holland, I think it was more of Calvinist than Lutheran. But anyways, you know, very similar, totally comparable in any case. And, you know, they had the pastor or preacher in the middle of this round building, very nicely done, stone building, brick building. On the highest point in the middle of the town, all streets kind of, you know, you can see the round church from far away, from many, many vantage points, from several canals away, you know, but then they found out that when they started doing that they're like, oh, you know what, this sucks, because half the congregation is always behind the pastor and they can't really hear what he's saying, or the pastor's just like turning around in circles the whole time, you know. So they're like, ah, screw it. So they, you know, they put the podium in the front, or they, you know, they call, they're like, okay, that's going to be the front, and they put the podium in the front, and then you know, they ended up doing the Catholic thing in the end, to the degree where they would even bury the dead beneath the floor stones, you know. And
oh, sure.
It was a totally Catholic church in the end, and they had the wealthier would be up on the they had balconies, and the poorer would be down below, and not so much the wealthier poor, but the very pious would show up first and get the balcony seats, and they'd be able to see who's showing up for Sunday service and who doesn't, you know. Like very, very, I don't want to say Puritan, but very reformed, you know, church, and trying to do everything different, and even different than the Lutherans, and, you know, yeah, interesting stuff, like really different, like very unique and very strong culture that is very different from, you know, I grew up in Bavaria, which is a stark contrast.
Yes, very different, stark contrast.
I had a crucifix in every one of my classrooms, you know, until I moved away. There was a crucifix in every room. Some teachers would say the Lord's Prayer, you know, and then cross themselves, you know, the whole class would cross themselves afterwards. That would not fly in East Frisia, you know. So,
that's the thing. We spend a lot of time on East Frisian or Ostfriesland. You know, Frisia is a lot bigger than that, of course. But, you know,
that wouldn't fly in Prussia. That wouldn't fly in Netherlands. That wouldn't fly in Cologne or Hamburg,
right,
or, you know,
right,
so Berlin because of Prussia. Yeah, I mean, yeah, we're talking about Frisia. But, yeah, there's definitely a north-south divide that you could have a lot of, you know, have a lot of generalities about those.
So I think that for our listeners, you know, on your show here, Travis, that it what this does is it probably gives you a greater idea behind all the very not nice jokes about Frisians and Ostfriesland, because what it is that it's a very different group of people, a very different geography, a very different thought or feel to Germany that people have a hard time connecting with as part of the, you know, the German family. And it is different. And I would say that instead of making fun of it, I'd say celebrate it. But if you get a chance to go to some of these great cities, and they're not great as far as size, they're great as far as, you know, nice day trips to make, Leer, Aurich, Emden, and I was mistaken. I said Aurich was, I think there was some bombing there during World War II, but mostly it was Emden because it was, a big car manufacturer at the time,
yeah,
for the Nazis.
Emden is much more industrial, for sure.
And that was completely destroyed, completely destroyed. But yet there today is a nice little town, and is a great museum in Emden that talks about Frisian history that goes back to the Paleolithic period, all the way through the points we talked about today. You have to see that. It is actually quite amazing. And they have a great art exhibit of great Frisian artists that are amazing in their own right. That if you haven't really seen them in some of these great places of museums in Europe, you can at least see some of that. It's just amazing stuff. So I, you know, to kind of summation of what I experienced there, I'll never forget it. I think I definitely understand why my family, the Colemans, came to the United States because of the crop blight that they had, just like they had in Ireland. The wars, the revolution between the German states before it became unified, there was just a lot of problems that forced a lot of Germans to the New World. And I can see that it looked a little bit like Southern Illinois along the Mississippi River. Uh-huh. And yeah. that area in the United States, no one wanted it. It was prairie land you couldn't really do anything with, except the Frisians knew what to do. Because they had the same crappy land.
They're like, we got this. So it flooded.
No big deal. This is what we live. We live with this. Yeah. So they knew how to make. They knew how to make lemonade out of lemons, and in the States, and they really, really changed the culture of the United States, Germans as a whole. And part of this massive migration in the 1840s and 50s and 60s, a lot of them came from Frisia. Through Bremerhaven and then on to the United States. So, I think it's an amazing story. It's a freedom of people trying to have their own autonomy. It's also a sad story of what they had to leave behind, because unlike today, when you left, you didn't come back. It was too expensive. Yeah. The trip was wrought with disaster. On a quick note, Travis, on this, I'm amazed at my great 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 grandparents, Reinhardt and Anna Margarita, that left in 1857. They left with three kids, and two of them died on the journey.
You're
talking about they lost almost everything coming through New Orleans and then on to St. Louis and Southern Illinois, and. You talk about having, either a strong belief in God to get you through it, from what I read that they had, but just the fortitude. And that really is an amazing thing to have read and found out about doing my genealogical research of my Frisian background.
Yeah, no, that's pretty interesting. Yeah. Yeah, and I'll get back to the Frisians now and then. We'll come across them when the Franks conquer them, when... like I said, when I do comparisons, because this way I can kind of shorten my History of the Netherlands miniseries by just comparing things to the Frisians and say, hey, go listen to that episode. So I'll mention them again now and then. But otherwise, that's pretty much it for the Frisians on the History of Germany podcast. If you liked what you heard, then, there's many more episodes out there. And we'll continue next time with, I might have you on the show again. You know what the next thing I might do, what I'm thinking about is German spa towns. And the reason I might have you on
the
show.
Like Karlovy, right?
Exactly right. I want to actually use Karlsbad or Karlovy Vary as the prime example of that kind of, and that's in today's Czech Republic. So, but there's obviously a lot of examples. The thing that people might not realize is why would we talk about like basically Roman baths kind of, but some are much more modern and they, some are from Roman times, but others, are from the 19th century or whatever. And that's because the whole, health spa sort of recovery, not necessarily rehab sort of thing, but just like health insurance to this day. In Germany covers it. If you can just say, hey, work is really stressing me out. And they're like, yeah, you know what? Go have a Kur. Like, it almost sounds like cure, go get cured. And Kur is the German word for, go to a spa town for a week and come back when you're fit,
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, that's
and,
the one thing.
And health insurance pays for that. Like, that's a very German idea. And so I wanted to okay, this is actually German. This is actually so German enough that I'm going to do a show on it. Like, I'll talk about Kur, about these spa towns in Germany.
That sounds like a great show. And we might definitely have to, air that with the Bohemian podcast because, we have definitely spa culture down here.
Yep. You could edit it differently and air it on Bohemian. It would apply just as much. Another one I wanted to mention is, these are all spoilers here, listeners, sorry, but, because the Czech Republic, they have one of them is, the old uranium mines. And you actually go down into these radioactive mines. And they're also, salt mines is another common place because it's just very dry. So
okay, but I want to throw this out to you.
This
they give you some water with uranium poison in it.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I should say, I do not condone this. I do not like any of these health treatments. I'm not like saying, you know, I'm not recommending any of these. I'm not a physician. I'm not qualified. Salt mines, I don't know if it has any effect or not. Uranium mines, I'm pretty sure is actually bad for you. I'm pretty sure that'll actually give you cancer. Right. I don't know. But so hey, if you want to hear more about that, stay tuned next episode. And I'm not sure if you'll just come in for the check parts, or you'll be here all show. But you know, we'll leave it as a surprise. Listeners will have to come back and find out. Besides that, we have a lot going on. We recently recorded an episode to kind of give everybody a preview of what's coming up in 2016. So I think I'll air that
on
here.
On all our amazing shows.
Yeah, air it here too. Definitely, I'll air it on History of Alchemy. We talk a lot about that. What's coming down 2016. What else, Pete? Your YouTube stuff.
Well, yeah,
right?
I want to mention the YouTube thing because when I was in East Frisia, I did some video for you and your show, Travis, on the history of Germany, about some of the places we talked about, from Emden to Reisum to small towns of Strakholt or Fierl, Ulrich. I did some stand-ups there to kind of talk more about what life was like, as well as just some imagery of the areas that we kind of talked about tonight on your show. So hopefully that can be up there pretty soon, and I'll put that also on the Bohemican YouTube channel, and so that everybody can see that. So I'll let you know when that's up and ready.
Yeah, when that happens, I'll tweet it out. I'll put it on Facebook, you know, the usual channels where you can find me. But I will also update the show notes of this episode. So whenever that is, in a month or two, or whenever that happens, just check back by thehistoryofgermanypodcast.com or bohemican.com. And, you know, if you look up Frisian freedoms, then I'll have a link, or I'll probably even have that video embedded in the same post. So you can, you know, where this episode is, you'll see that video too. So, but yeah, there's some good Bohemican videos out there. There's a History of Alchemy one out there. There's no History of Germany videos yet. I don't know if there will be. I don't want to make any promises, but if you want to watch some videos and actually see some of the places we talk about, the Czech Republic is very German. Can I say that?
No.
So stay tuned for all that. Some of those are out there on YouTube right now. The Bohemican YouTube channel is what you're searching for. There's links everywhere. Links on Podcastnik, links on historyofgermanypodcast.com, bohemican.com. So, yep, go there, check it out. Stay tuned. Buy t-shirts. I'm kind of kidding, but someone did, so thank you very much. You can go look at Bohemican and Alchemy t-shirts. And come say hi on Twitter and Facebook. And thank you very much for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.